Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to another U.S. Politics Online Blog Talk Radio. This is show number 13. As for the Constitution, I'm your host, Chauncey Brown, and my co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler, author of Locke in America. Welcome, Professor. How are you this afternoon?
A little sleepy, but I'll make it through.
I hope so, because we have a lot of information that we're going to share with the American people today that's very important, and we don't need you to fall asleep on us. Also, I want to mention to our listeners that if you want to look at any of our prior shows, you can go to U.S. National Politics Online on Facebook. However, I also want our listeners to be aware that within the next couple of weeks, we are going to be moving to a new blog talk radio show called The Declaration, American Declaration, I believe.
Yes.
Okay? So just to give our listeners a heads up, we're going to jump right in. Doctor, and I'm going to start off with a question, as we usually do. So today we are continuing our discussion of our true founding principles. In the June 4th broadcast, you answered the question, how limited was limited government meant to be? The Declaration of Independence made a government a protector, protecting our natural and unalienable rights, protecting all in the right to live our lives as we please, to live and let live. American government was not to provide advantages to some at others' expense. We are all created equal, and this equal creation demands equal protection under the law, equal application of the law for all. You've argued that since government derive their just powers from the consent of govern, and since the govern, neither one nor all, may take away or give away what belongs to another, governments may not tax Peter to pay Paul, or vice versa. In last week's show, you borrowed from John Locke and Ayn Rand to establish once and for all that all men and women, in fact, are created equal and endowed with their inestimable rights of life, liberty, prosperity, self-defense, and above all, the right to pursue happiness unimpeded by an overbearing government. Dr. Hyler, at the end of last week's conversation, you also showed that the framers of the Constitution followed the founders in their strong desires to protect and defend men's natural and irrevocable individual rights. You spoke of how the mortgage stay laws, the paper money emissions, and legal tender enacts benefited debtors but violated the contractual rights of creditors, who were legally forced to accept depreciated money and payments of debts of far greater value. Can we conclude that both founding documents shared the same ends, that the 1786 frame of government was deliberately designed to achieve the ends expressed in the 1776 Declaration?
It's complicated. Of the two documents, only the Constitution carries the status of law. Conformity to its provisions determine the legitimacy or illegitimacy of all statutes passed by Congress and signed by an elected president. The Declaration is merely a statement of principles, bearing no legal status whatsoever. No one ever went to jail for violating the, quote, self-evident truths, unquote, Jefferson proclaimed once upon a time. Considering, one, that the Constitution today forms no barrier against the spread of socialism in this country, and two, the many ways socialist policies stifle individual liberty and empower governments to control our thought and actions, it's brutally clear that our lawmakers are paying scant attention to the ideas enshrined in Jefferson's July 4th Declaration. So it certainly couldn't hurt to delve deeper into the connection between America's two founding documents. In the first place, whereas the Declaration declares a number of deep moral and political truths, the Constitution mainly organizes the forms and procedures governments are to adapt.
So, doctor, is there an abiding relationship between the two compositions? Inquiring minds want to know. Our listeners will recall how Benjamin Rush distinguished between the principles of government and the forms of government. The former, he said, were simple. Once Locke carefully laid them out in the second treatise of the government, deciding what forms government must be adopted in order to realize those principles. That was the hard part.
Exactly. Ever since the 4th century BC and the writings of Aristotle, thinkers contributed to what came to be called not moral philosophy, but the Republican science of politics. This age-old discourse featured great minds offering well-developed accounts of how governments should be organized, that is, the proper forms they must take.
Dr. Heiler, for what purpose? What exactly were these writers out to defend?
The answer is freedom, human liberty, understood in two related senses. Freedom meant self-rule, that is, freedom from being swallowed up and enslaved by foreign invaders. That was one form of freedom. Eventually, freedom came to be seen as in the sense of self-rule in a personal sense, being free to live as one chooses, without being controlled by one's own government and its interfering ways. Of course, both aspects were desired. So the question was, how do we arrange the institutions of government to protect freedom in both senses? Nearly all parties to the Constitutional Convention convened in 1787 subscribed to Locke's moral and political principles. They contended only over how to frame a government so as to best assure that those principles would be respected and adhered to over the course of time.
Doctor, that's a strange claim in a sense. The Constitution doesn't include any of the Declaration's principles. It doesn't say that all men are created equal and endowed with their certain unalienable rights, or that to secure these rights, government or institutions are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
No, the Constitution didn't include any of that. But it is a social contract drafted by men who recently fought a war of independence to establish the rights and liberties to which all men are entitled and which all men naturally possess. Now, there is a great significance to the fact that the Declaration's language was not reprised in the Constitutional Convention. Nevertheless, I say that the U.S. Constitution and every article and clause in it testifies to the framers' firm commitment to Locke's conception of individual rights and limited government. And that includes the right to gain, keep, use, trade, or otherwise dispose of all freely acquired property. But to vindicate this view, a number of historical gaps must be filled in.
Professor, I think our listeners would like to hear how you defend that claim.
First point, Locke was not alone in transmitting his philosophy of liberty to the 18th century, and specifically to 13 North American British colonies. He had lots of help. A long line of intermediaries, British and American authors, essayists, pamphleteers, learned historians, lawyers, and other public figures transmitted Locke's history-making message to every part of the English-speaking world. Colonial Americans who never read a page or paragraph of Locke's second treatise were fully apprised of liberty's irresistible appeal and wider implications for organizing political relations. What Americans came in contact with as well is known as Britain's opposition press.
So this opposition press carried Locke's ideas to colonial America?
Indeed, precisely so. In his indispensable study called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, Bernard Bailyn the preeminent historian, intellectual historian of the period, described the influence of the 18th century opposition writers. Participants were also known as Commonwealth men for their interest in the history of republics. Republics, or commonwealths, differed from monarchies that were ruled by a king and his royal bloodline. So Balin wrote, quote, "What gave the ideology of the American Revolution its distinctive character? What dominated the colonists' miscellaneous learning and shaped it into a coherent whole was the influence of these 18th century Commonwealth men. From the earliest years, 18th century, of the Republic, this opposition thought was devoured by the colonists. It nourished their political thought and sensibility so that there seems never to have been a time after the Hanoverian succession, succession of George I to the throne of England, when these writings were absent from polemical politics. Now, no production played a larger role in shaping the colonial outlook than did Cato's letters. Between 1720 and 1723, two Englishmen, John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon, published 144 essays on liberty, civil and religious. Collected and released in four volumes, Cato's letters were immediately snapped up by the American colonists. They became the most widely read work the founders consulted as the imperial crisis evolved. The themes developed by Cato were promoted by a long line of opposition writers across the 18th century. For the most part, these were the dissenters, Britons who stood outside the established Church of England, the Anglican Church. As such, they couldn't vote, attend Oxford or Cambridge universities, or hold a wide assortment of public offices, including as educators in the public schools. Yet, being scientists, inventors, enlightened intellectuals, and the fathers of their respective industries, men like Isaac Watt, Richard Price, Joseph Priestley, Josiah Wedgwood, they were among the most productive public-spirited citizens of their day. There was a lot for them to oppose.
So Locke wasn't alone in transmitting ideas about individual rights and government's duty to defend them and do nothing more?
No, he wasn't alone. But it wasn't just about transmitting Locke's ideas alone. Yes, Trenchard and Gordon faithfully reprised the full Lockean outlook on life and liberty, and in language thoroughly reminiscent of Locke's own. They were firmly committed to the whole natural right, state of nature, social contract theories Locke had expounded. But these Lockeans captured as well other currents of thought that floated about in their enlightened times. These matters related to the Republican science of politics and a most somber assessment of human nature. That's the second point. Colonial Americans were among the most educated citizens of their day, or any other for that matter. They studied the lessons of history endlessly and let those lessons light their path. They realized they would have to understand the past to really improve the future and preserve liberty. Trenchard and Gordon mastered those lessons and can transmit them in clear and compelling prose. No lesson mattered more than recognition of the awful influence of power on human affairs. Nothing could be more important than suspiciously eyeing those who sought or exercised power over their societies. That is why, as Jefferson said, the price of liberty had to be eternal vigilance. Informing Cato's views were first a dark and disturbing portrait of human nature, and second, a series of reports that could not help but confirm that somber and distressing portrait. Alluding to Thomas Hobbes, the author of Leviathan, Trenchard and Gordon wrote, "A great philosopher calls the state of nature a state of war. which definition is true. Were all men left to the boundless liberty which they claim from nature, where there's no government, every man would be plundering the acquisitions of another. The labor of one man would be the property of another. Weakness would be the prey of force, and one man's industry would be the cause of another man's idleness. Now, this may be inferred not merely from the experience of all human societies, which Cato could ably recite, but from the very motor of human conduct. This is Cato writing, quote, "The world is governed by men, and men by their passions, which, being boundless and insatiable, are always terrible when they are not controlled. Who was ever satisfied with riches, or surfeited with power, or tired with honors? There is nothing so terrible or mischievous, but human nature is capable of it. Men seldom or never stop at certain degrees of mischief when they have the power to go further, but hurry on from wickedness to wickedness as far and as fast as human malice can prompt human power."
We are U.S. National Politics Online. We are listening to Dr. Jerome Hyler, author of Locke in America, As for the Constitution. I'm your host, Chauncey Brown. We want to thank all our listeners. So, Professor, what are you setting up, and what dominated the thought of the Americans in an age-old and ongoing battle between liberty and power?
That's exactly how to describe it. A battle between liberty and power. They are the mortal enemies of one another. Again, here's Trenchard and Gordon. Quote, "Power is naturally active, vigilant, and distrustful. It would do what it pleases and have no check. Now, because liberty chastises and shortens power, therefore power would extinguish liberty, and consequently liberty has too much cause to be exceedingly jealous and always upon her defense." End quote. Cato dwells endlessly on the loss of liberty in lands near and far. Much like Machiavelli, he discusses in endless detail the cunning practices of corrupt princes and ministers. The effects of power were readily apparent. Quote, "Let us look around this great world and behold what an immense majority of the whole race of men crouch under the yoke of a few tyrants, naturally as low as the meanest of themselves, and by being tyrants, worse than the worst." End quote.
Doctor, we might interrupt your narrative long enough to notice that nothing much has changed since Cato's day. Look around the world right now. See how many millions suffering under suffocating despotism and power-hungry tyrants who exert total control over their population. It certainly is worth noticing what astute observers of human nature, John Trenchard, Thomas Gordon, and their many American admirers were. Cato concludes,
in fact, quote, "Let us therefore grow wise by the misfortunes of others. Let their virtues and their vices and the punishment of them too be an example to us, and so prevent our miseries from being an example to other nations. In fine, let us examine and look narrowly into every part of our Constitution," now is the British Constitution, "and see if any corruptions or abuses have crept or galloped into it. Time and again, free societies succumb to power's alluring veneer. Corruption, once underway, invariably spread until human freedom became a fading memory of bygone days. It is from this perspective that Americans interpret colonial relations with an imperial motherland, fought a brutal war of independence, then assembled in 1787 to compose the U.S. Constitution. With Cato, Balin reports, the colonists studied the processes of decay and dwelt endlessly on the evidence of corruption they saw about them in the British government. Everywhere, they agreed, there was corruption, corruption, technically in the adroit manipulation of Parliament by a power-hungry ministry, and corruption generally in the self-indulgence and feminizing luxury and gluttonous pursuit of gain. In other words, there was too much concern with private affairs at the time and not enough concern with what is going on in public affairs.
Okay, so if that was the problem, what could be the solution? What could prevent their own free way of life from coming to the ravages of power? How could human ingenuity figure out what it would take to keep government within its proper limits and not expand endlessly at liberty's expense?
Well, that brings us to the third point. While it would be necessary to count on men's virtue, their willingness to respect one another's rights and liberties, and be ever watchful of how their public servants were conducting themselves, history proved to the colonists that wouldn't work forever. Being wholly absorbed in their private affairs, the people will eventually lose interest in public affairs.
Boy, that doesn't describe America life as it's lived right now.
Yes, it does. Exactly. The founders understood that what they called civic virtue, that is, participation in public affairs, rarely endured over time. In attending to their private affairs, people grow insensitive to the slow, gradual loss of the precious blessings of liberty they for so long are able to take for granted. In erecting government, those concerned with preserving liberty would have to count on something else other than eternal vigilance to stave off power's awful influence. Several arrangements recommended themselves. For one thing, specific guarantees could be incorporated into the fundamental frame, hence a Bill of Rights that allowed for free speech, a free press, religious freedom, the right to petition government for a redress of grievances, and a presumption of innocence made perfect sense. Free and frequent elections would also be necessary. Above all, a rotation of magistracy, that is what we call term limits, needed to be imposed. Why? Since even the most honest men will succumb to the temptations of power if permitted to hold office for indefinite periods, just like power itself, terms of public service had to be limited. For those sharing Locke's commitments, one other arrangement would be deemed absolutely essential. In the annals of the Republican science of politics, it was known as the mixed regime. To preserve liberty, power would have to be separated into different departments and made to be a check on power itself. It is only by making power a check on power that liberty could withstand the ravages of time. In Federalist Paper number 51, that was the series of essays that called for the ratification of the Constitution. James Madison made it crystal clear, quote, "To preserve liberty, power must be placed against power in order that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? The U.S. Constitution is little more than a complex web of checks and balances, bestowing power on separate and independent political bodies. This was accomplished vertically with the creation of three semi-sovereign branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, as well as horizontally via what is known as federalism. Thus, every state retained its sovereignty under the Constitution with regard to internal lawmaking and regulation. The lengths to which the Constitution goes to thwart the designs of ambitious and corrupt office holders seeking to subvert the liberties of the people and place power in their own hands is abundant proof that it was the more perfect union the framers labored to bring into the world, that was to be a land where individual liberty could flourish.
Let me see if I get this. You say that in addition to Locke's treatment of individual liberty and the need for government with limited powers to protect the liberties of the people, there were at least two additional political languages in play. One pointed out a somber reality, how power was ever pursued by some at the expense of others, expense of liberty. The other, which you call the science of politics, was a discourse that sought to construct a plan of union that could defeat power's awful age-old impact on once free societies. And so from this, you conclude that the U.S. Constitution, every bit as much as Jefferson's immortal July 4th Declaration, was a blueprint designed to establish a Lockean republic, designed, as it expressly says, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
Yes, that is what I would argue, except there is one oddity. The Constitution did not explicitly say that's all it was meant to be and all it was meant to do. It didn't say anything by way of fundamental principles. Unlike many of the state constitutions that were drafted once independence was declared, it fails to identify government's limited powers and purposes. The Constitution could have said, as the Virginia state constitution written by George Mason did say, quote, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, of which when they enter into the state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. In Massachusetts, John Adams, and this was 4 years later in 1780, wrote into Massachusetts Constitution, all men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. I'm afraid that what I must ultimately conclude is this. Because the fundamental principles enshrined in Jefferson's July 4th Declaration never found their way into the U.S. Constitution, the founding principles would not survive the founding era, and American government grew and grew and grew and is still growing in power at the expense of liberty and at the high cost that Americans are having to pay for all of this.
Dr. Heiler, thank you very much for giving us a very insight on the philosophy of liberty as it relates to the Constitution. I hope that everyone will join us next week at U.S. National Politics Online for a continuing conversation about the importance of liberty in America. Dr. Heiler, once again, I want to thank you for sharing this insightful information with the American people, and I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. Please join us next week, Tuesday, at 4 o'clock with Dr. Jerome Heiler, author of Locke in America, for another exciting radio show. Dr. Heiler, thank you very much again.
Thank you, Chauncey.
You're welcome. Have a blessed day, and God bless America.
Indeed.